listener production.
The person who was beside me, she was starting to panic and she was just yelling out. I remember at the time she was saying, "Don't brake, don't brake, don't brake." It seemed to me like the only logical thing that I could actually do to avoid us actually hitting this tree that was coming up. And so I tapped on the brakes. And that's when the car flipped.
This episode's all about the importance of conditions, road surfaces in particular. Hi, everybody. I'm Rusty.
And I'm Lisa.
Welcome to the Keep Your Wheels On podcast, where you're going to hear from real people talking about the mistakes that either resulted in them crashing their car or narrowly avoiding a situation that could have been much worse. And along the way, we'll be joined by experts to chat about how you can do your best to avoid ending up in a similar situation. Lease road surfaces and conditions. Sometimes we get a bit blasé about that. We get in the car, we turn the car on, we start it, off we go. Well, we don't always pause to think about that, do we?
I mean, it's just another thing we're not trained for. People do all their hours on plain bitumen. They don't go out in the rain or, you know, not on gravel surfaces or ice or anything like that. And people really don't understand the differences in traction and control you have on all those different surfaces, and whether or not the conditions are about weather, traffic, road, whatever, that's what we need to actually improve on.
Not to mention the state of the roads in some countries aren't great, particularly post-COVID. Our guest today, our expert, has won the great race in Australia, the Bathurst 1000, on four occasions. What you may not know about Greg Murphy is that he is a passionate advocate around driver training. He has a great program in New Zealand called the Street Smart Program, aimed at young kids and giving them practical, real skills to help them cope on the road. Murph, as we welcome you to this episode, why is it so important that we tell our young drivers about that awareness of road surfaces and driving to the conditions?
Yeah, g'day guys. Hey, thanks for having me here tonight. I'm very passionate about improving road safety across the board, but in particular, the youth that are embarking on the adventure of driving on the roads. You know, we talk about driving safe. Well, what the hell does driving safe mean? What do you do to drive safe? You know, it's not just about knowing the road rules. It's understanding so much more than that. And, you know, understanding surfaces, as you guys are talking about, and the differences and what it means and the connection with the road. What connects you with the road? Well, four very, very small contact patches from your four tires are what connects you with the road. And the condition that those are in, depending on, you know, the conditions that you are driving in, plays such a massive part. And unfortunately, majority of people don't understand why tires are what they are and why they have tread and what their job is and why it's so important to have them in good condition either. So there's so many layers that are missed through the process. And you know, I'm big on trying to explain and offer up some real basic stuff that's not part of the learning process.
The name SCAFE is synonymous in Australian sport and motorsport in particular. Lisa's ended up with My Drive School. You've ended up with Street Smart. Can we get an understanding from you, mate, about where the passion for this came from? Why has it become so important to you?
I'll take a little back step and just actually give you a little example of a situation that I got myself into when I was 19 years old. And I very fortuitously, and it was just pure good luck and fate that I got a second chance. But I was one night late after midnight, Easter 1991 it was, you know, had been spending the weekend with friends and been drinking as well and bits and pieces and just having a good time. And I was very fatigued, tired, and I ended up taking a friend of mine home, which was about 25 minutes out from where I lived in the country. And on the way back, myself and a passenger in the car next to me, we're talking in the 90s, so I was driving a Datsun 1200 back then. Mm-hmm. Nothing too fast or furious, that's for sure, but it doesn't need to be to make a mistake. And I was fatigued, wasn't driving too fast, but I wasn't paying attention. Came around a corner, dropped the left-hand side of the car off the verge onto a loose surface verge, lost control, spun around 180 degrees, crossed the road onto a grass bank, down a bank and into some trees. Pitch black, it was like 12:30 at night, 1 o'clock in the morning. And I vividly remember thinking that I had killed the passenger that was in the car with me. All I could see was a face looking at me, trying to breathe and eyes wide open. And this is in the pitch black. I could see this. And I thought I'd killed someone. Fortunately, that wasn't the case. Very badly winded, fractured collarbone. Emergency services turned up. We were off the road. No one could see us where we were. Alerted emergency services. No cell phones back then either, 1991. So someone had to drive off to a house and ring emergency services and come out and get my passenger out, take it to hospital. So very terrifying experience. I remember, and I know from that point on, I got a wake-up call, massive, massive wake-up call. And as I say, got a second chance to change my behaviours, change what I was doing. Thought I was 10 foot tall and bulletproof, just like every young teenage male does behind the wheel of a car. And I knew from that moment on that I was very fortunate, very lucky to have that second chance, because so many people don't. You know, I ended up going into a motor racing career and, you know, doing all these amazing things. I was very lucky to do that. And it was about probably 15 years ago, I got a phone call from a journalist in New Zealand wanting comment about a terrible Easter road toll that we'd had in New Zealand. And I was a little bit sort of taken back and didn't really know what to say about it at the time, but it got me intrigued and subsequently took more interest and subsequently then started to get more phone calls. And I just started to really pay more attention to what was going on. And I soon became very aware of the fact that there were so many people unnecessarily dying on the roads. And over that this period of time, 15 years, understanding more about it has been something that has been a passion project for me. And it's very, very clear to see that we just do not prepare drivers accordingly. We've also had things change over the last 10 or so years. It's even longer potentially, but distraction has become such a terrible thing. It's an epidemic in our countries around what's causing so many crashes and mistakes and errors and bad decisions. But it's again about awareness, preparation, proper training and education, and it's just not there. So how are you supposed to know if you don't know? And that's what's going on with many of the people that are finding themselves in crashes and being injured and killed in New Zealand and Australia.
Greg, throughout his professional competition career, has driven on many different surfaces, even did some rallying for a time. What we want to do now is to go back to the story we had at the top of the podcast here. This is someone who absolutely could have learned a thing or two about driving on dirt roads. Let's meet the person behind that story and find out how they came to be in that situation.
Hi, my name's Luke. I rolled a car while driving too fast on the very first dirt road that I'd ever driven on. Despite what I just said there, I generally would consider myself to be a pretty good driver. I was quite late to start driving. It was a case of not having access to a car. I couldn't really afford lessons. I didn't have anyone in the family that was able to teach me either. So driving just sort of became something that wasn't really that important to me, and I was just using public transport a lot. It was when I was at uni, actually, that one of my friends who I was living with at the time, she said, she was like, you've never driven, you've never done a driving lesson, I'll get you out there in my car and I'll teach you how to drive. She was great, and we were driving around a car park and things like that, and I made some decent mistakes, even to the point of there was one area where it was a ledge, and I don't know what I was thinking, but I was focusing on driving the car. I didn't see this ledge coming up, and so I drove off it. It was a decent drop. It was a drop of, you know, 20 centimetres, and that might not sound like a lot, but when you're driving a car quite slowly, and I'm sure she thought I was just going to stop as well, but I drove off the ledge, and, you know, where most people being with their parents, that would have been a problem. Look what you've done to the car. She found it quite funny, which I was pretty lucky with, I suppose. But that was where I learnt how to drive. My very first car was bought from someone who I worked with. She was just going to be dumping this old one. She was not expecting to be able to sell it. And so I sort of piped up and I said, I'll take the car off your hands. And she said to me, she was like, you can have it for $800 if you want it. There's some issues with it, but you can take it away for $800. So I did. She drove it into work that day and she said, oh, the car's downstairs, here's the keys. And all of a sudden, you know, I'd not been driving much at all outside of these lessons that I'd had with my friend. I owned a car and it was downstairs in the car park. And it was very banged up. There was a leak of something underneath the car as well, which told me that that probably wasn't a good thing. And I remember sitting in this car and thinking, I was like, well, I've got to try and get this home now. And so I turned out of the work car park, and I remember turning left because that felt easier than turning right. And I managed to get home, turning only left the entire way home. It took me far longer than it should have because home was right, but managed to get myself home doing exclusively left turns. These days, I can now turn right, so there's been some development there. As far as getting my license, the only turning left thing probably gives you some understanding of the fact that I was quite an anxious driver. So I went and did my driving test. This is in New Zealand that I did this at first. And the guy said to me, who did the test with me, he said, look, I can see that you know what you're doing. Yes, you've made some mistakes here today, but I feel like it's partly just down to anxiety and you're a little bit stressed about stuff. And he said, I'm going to pass you. And I don't know if it was just because, like, I went at lunchtime, like it was, you know, he was probably just wanting to not go and fill in the paperwork or whatever, but whatever happened, I got my learner's license. I stayed with that for a few years. I then moved to Australia. And when I moved to New South Wales, I got here and I said to them, I said, look, I want to transfer my license across. I've got a New Zealand learner's license. And they said, yep, that's fine. How long have you had it for? It had been a few years. And they said, oh, well, the good news is that actually transfers into your green peas. And so straight away, I was put onto my green pea license in New South Wales. And then I moved to Queensland for work. And when I got up there, I said, look, I've got a New South Wales green pea license. And they said, oh, well, the good news is the amount of time that you've had that license down there, you can now transfer that for a full Queensland license. So I transferred it to a full Queensland license. And then when I moved back to New South Wales a few years later, they said, oh, well, you've already got a full Queensland license. That transfers to a full New South Wales license. So I don't know if it's the recommended way of getting your driver's license, but it avoids the testing process a little bit for you. I wouldn't recommend it, though. Incredibly expensive to have to move every time when you just don't want to do a test.
There is a lot to unpack from that, and you can't see it because this is an audio experience. Murph basically has his head in his hands. The licensing system is broken in so many places, mate, for reasons like this, isn't it? Where does he start, he says.
Yep, that was my next words. Was where do you start with that? That is a hell of a story. I don't know how, through circumstance, Luke managed to get through the system fairly easily in any respects. But just him talking initially about the early stages of it, it can be a very anxious process and a difficult process. And again, he didn't have the support or the money to be able to go through the correct training. And he's managed to fumble his way through it. And a lot of people do that. It's having access to the right tools and being able to go through the right process and get the lessons. And a lot of people don't go through the lessons. A lot of people do manage to pass the test through various ways and means, and others prepare very, very well. But at the end of the day, the tests are still very, very simple. A lot do fail, but they fail for very minor indiscretions, which are important. But let's just say, for example, I know, you know, a lot of people at coming up through one of the tests that happen where I live in Hawke's Bay in Napier, the test course is the same for everybody every single day, all the way through. So the driver trainers, if you're lucky enough and can afford to go and get a driving lesson, they take you around the course to prepare you for driving that course. So if you fail after having a lesson and driving around the course and them telling you what to do at every single stage, then really you shouldn't be driving at all. But a lot of failures are because someone doesn't actually come to a complete stop at the stop sign. They slow down, right down, and the wheels just are still moving before they drive away again. And that's an instant fail. But people are able to drive the cars. But again, I come back to, they're not safe. They're not actually safe drivers. They're drivers that are capable of passing the test. That doesn't make you safe. And when you get a full license, yes, you've gone through the processes and maybe you've had your license for a couple of years, but people just are not going through and improving their skill sets and their knowledge and their awareness and being able to identify the risks that are out there when we're driving. And that's what we do at Street Smart. We create it's an awareness program that identifies risks and makes them cognitive. So your brain is actually absorbing the information through practical means, because driving is not theoretical. It is a practical task, you know, being able to understand different surfaces, as you said, and what's required and how to drive on different surfaces. And you can't teach all that in 5 minutes either. That's a very difficult thing. But understanding it through talking about it and doing practical courses like we do at Street Smart to understand what emergency braking is and what you can do with ABS brakes and knowing what ABS is in your car, which I estimate it in New Zealand to be 80 to 85% of drivers have no idea what ABS is. So what's the point in having it if you don't know what it is? And it's one of the most, if not in my book, the best piece of safety that's ever been built into a motor vehicle is ABS, yet no one knows how to use it.
Just so we can remove any assumed knowledge, we often talk in acronyms, I know. So ABS, anti-lock braking system, just describe that. And, you know, for people that aren't aware of what it can do, just let them know.
A car that does not have ABS, you slam your foot on the brake and put a heap of pressure into the brake system, the wheels will lock up, particularly the front wheels, because most of the balance of braking performance is in the front, and the car, obviously, when it pitches forward, puts more weight on the front wheels. So if you put a heap of brake pressure into a car without ABS, the front wheels lock up and they will stay locked, and the car will go in the direction you're traveling at the moment they lock, no matter what you do with the steering wheel. So you lose ability to steer. And basically, you just travel until the friction from the locked wheels brings you to a stop. What ABS does, it's a system in the braking system. It basically brakes and releases the pressure on the braking system. So very, very quickly puts pressure and it instantaneously sort of locks the wheel and then releases and then goes back on again. So pressure goes on and off automatically through a pump system and through the electronics in the car. And basically, the wheels don't lock. They won't lock up. So they are still rotating. Even though you've got massive brake pressure on the system, the wheels will continue to turn. And that allows you to turn the steering wheel and keep your foot hard on the brake, slowing the car down at maximum deceleration while still maintaining steering input and directional change. And so you can stamp your foot hard on the brake pedal, slow the car down, and also steer at the same time, look for a gap or look for a different part of the road where you're not going to make contact potentially with a vehicle or another object. So it's an amazing system that if you have knowledge of it and how it works, it is so usable in so many everyday circumstances.
I'm totally with you, Murph. I mean, emergency braking, as a driver, as you'd know, like, is one of the most important things anybody will ever be taught to do in a car, yet it's not part of any test anywhere. And you go, we've actually put it in drive school as a module all by itself. We do an emergency braking exercise at 40Ks, 50Ks, 60Ks, and then again in the wet to show the differences. So many accidents at the moment are caused by people running straight up the back of somebody, or the ABS comes on and it sort of stutters and they think there's something wrong with the car, so they take their foot off the brake and sort of defeats the purpose, and then they're going to crash. And you go, we're not teaching people how to use ABS. As you said, there's no point having it if we're not teaching people how to use it. It is a great safety feature, but nobody knows what to do with it.
But the ridiculous thing, Lise, is that all our ANCAP safety ratings and everything, all cars that go through their safety ratings are all judged on all these safety features. And there's a lot more these days with obviously all the ADAS, the advanced driver safety, you know, technology and all that kind of stuff. But ABS is part of getting a 5-star safety rating. How does it get a 5-star safety rating if you're not teaching anybody how to use the bloody thing? We're so upside down.
Absolutely. I mean, I look at it in terms of our fatality rates over the last, you know, 50 years. Every aspect of road safety has been changed and modified except for the way we actually teach people how to drive. The safety features in cars are great, but we haven't taught people how to use them.
Well, that's the only reason the road tolls aren't astronomically higher now, with more people on the roads, more cars on the road, is because the manufacturers and the billions and billions and billions they've put into building cars stronger and better, airbags, all that kind of stuff, they're saving lives. They're changing outcomes when people already have lost control. There's no coming back because they've got no control anymore of the vehicle, and fate steps in to determine what happens. And depending on what they're going to crash into and how fast they're going at that moment where they've lost control, the car is the last line of that defense. And the cars are a lot safer now than what they were 10, 20, 30, 40. And when I was driving and wrote my car off in 1990, it was a 1972 Datsun. It was at that point, it was only 18 years old. It wasn't safe. It wasn't designed to hit anything at any stage, at any speed. And we were killing people in New Zealand in the early 90s and late 80s, 600-700 people a year. We're now 380 people a year, but we should be doing so much better than that.
Do you think most people consider themselves, I think Luke said it in his comment there, do you think most people consider themselves better drivers than they actually are? Do they have that sense of themselves or feel that way?
People want to be good drivers because it's important. It's a stature thing. You know, it's like, I'm a good driver. You know, it's important to think that you are. And so people definitely believe they're better than what they are because you put them into a very simple situation where they have to make a decision. And we see this in controlled environment stuff. You know, we ask the drivers that come to Street Smart, they rate themselves, you know, so they talk about how they feel before they drive and do the program. You know, they self-assess. And the rates are a lot higher at the initial phase before they go any testing compared to when we ask them to self-assess at the end of it. So generally, people think they're better than what they are because they don't want to admit that they're terrible drivers as well.
Is testing more regularly something that you think we should think about, or is it just training?
100%. It's just ludicrous that you don't have to go and resit your driver's license. And people are terrified at that thought, right? They do it once. It's done. It's out of the way. It's terrifying when you're doing it the first time. There's no goddamn way I want to do it a second time. It was, you know, the worst experience of my life was getting tested. And that's why we should have to do it more often, because you need to be put under pressure to actually go and do the work to be prepared, just like you do when you're sitting any kind of exam for anything at all that's going to move you forward in university or in your job. People aren't afraid to go and do extra learning to progress in a career. But my God, you suggest they go and do a sit their license again, they'll run a mile.
Let's go back to Luke's story now and find out, let's drill down, what happened to him on the day of the accident.
The majority of my driving was city driving. It was very rare that I would be anywhere that was away from, you know, other traffic around and somewhere that was in less than ideal road conditions. So the day that I actually had the accident, it was a car that was somebody else's from work. We were driving inland, heading to a work location that was remote, and I was behind the wheel. I hadn't been the whole time. They had driven for the majority of the trip. They had had enough. They were like, do you mind if I have a break? Are you happy to drive for a bit? So I got behind the wheel. I would have been about 23 at the time. It was me in the car driving, and beside me was this other person who I was working with. We were in the middle of nowhere, and so there was a few of us that were doing this drive, and so we weren't entirely on our own. We were inland by a lot. There was nothing around except just dirt roads and dust everywhere. Like, it was sunny, it was, you know, there was no rain on the roads or anything like that, which for me, that was always the sort of thing that if you're worried about a car accident, if the road's wet, that's when you're likely to have your issues, right? I didn't think about the fact that because it was so dry, that would also alter the road conditions as well and change how I should have probably been driving on them. I didn't drive on dirt roads at all, but I was like, you know what, this is no different. I started driving, the car moved in the same way that the car would move when I was driving on a normal road in the city. And so I picked up confidence pretty quickly. I was doing around 100k an hour, and I came up to a corner and I was going too fast. And so I tapped on the brakes, but because this was dirt, it reacted entirely differently. And so the car, instead of just, you know, slowly slowing down enough that it was easy for me to make that corner comfortably, the back of the car just started to swing out towards the edge of the road. Now, I'd never had to deal with a situation before where the car was doing that, and so I didn't really know what to do. I thought that perhaps I should try and correct that, and so I steered into the side that the car was actually spinning out to try and sort of get it to straighten up a little bit. That just sort of made the actual spin worse. I had the person who was beside me, she was starting to panic and she was just yelling out. I remember at the time she was saying, don't brake, don't brake, don't brake. I'm listening to her say that while I was trying to correct this car, but the whole time I'm seeing that there's this tree which is off to the side of the road.
I can see from you that there's many aspects to this. I want to come back to something you said earlier, and that is about driving to the conditions. If you've not driven on dirt before, I think you said just slow down. that kind of bravado where he was talking about, oh, it's 100 k's an hour, how hard can it be, and so on. I mean, you have to be able to drive to the road condition, don't you?
Well, he was also, he'd never driven on a loose surface before. And as he said, he got onto the surface, it was very dry, and he felt that it was very similar to a hard surface, asphalt, you know, chip seal road, and off he went. But again, that just highlights the awareness around these things, right? Mm. So where in the process of him getting a driver's license did anyone talk to him about that? Nowhere. Mm. So he's making it up as he goes along, and he was in a situation that gave him confidence, and so off he went. So that there's a problem in itself, and it goes back to the teaching and the learning and the education, doesn't it, straight away, which isn't talked about. So yes, he was at fault because he had a conceived sort of perception of the situation. But I suppose the other thing of that is he was in a road he'd never driven on before. When you're on roads that you've never driven on, you don't know them, you've got to be cautious about that. You know, so there was a couple of obviously significant factors there, and that's what brought him undone.
I mean, when it comes down to it, you don't know what you don't know. So unless people are taught and trained properly, you know, you can't expect people to know that. But, I mean, when we used to do driver training stuff, I mean, our basic rule of thumb was if you're ever going to hit anything, hit it as slow as possible at all times. Just if you're going to hit it, jam on the brakes and hit it as slow as possible.
Mm. For a starter, the surface is different. So perhaps in the same way you talk at Street Smart about wet surfaces and how drivers, what things they need to do on a wet surface. I mean, clearly the tyres' behaviour on the dirt, the dry dirt surface, what it does underneath you and so on, the grip that it has is significantly different to city roads that so many people listening to this would be conditioned to or used to.
And to be fair, the majority of passenger vehicles, you're buying them to drive them on hard surfaces like asphalt or chip seal or motorways, general roads, residential style stuff, and then motorways and the likes, right? So they come with tyres that are designed for those conditions predominantly. Yes, the tyres on them still will work okay on those different loose surfaces and the likes, but they're not. It's not designed for them. So for people that live in the country, they have different tyres on their cars because that's the predominant kind of surfaces they drive on. So again, there's not that knowledge and understanding of that.
In most states, they've got to do, you know, 10, maybe 20 hours of nighttime training, but they don't have to do any sort of training on different sorts of roads, whether or not that's country roads with, you know, crappy edges or gravel roads, or, you know, they can get their license 1 week and then go up to go snow skiing that weekend and on those windy roads with snow all over them. We don't have a good broad experience base to actually make our kids do. And then when they go for a test and every instructor knows that route that they do, and that's all they're tested with.
Mm. Murph, it probably sounds like a stupid question here, but for people that haven't driven on a dirt road before, right, just some of the things that change in the behaviour of the car, from the vibration through the steering wheel. In Luke's example, he talked about the back end stepping around on him, which you guys often refer to as oversteer, and the inability to catch that. Just talk about some of that stuff.
Okay, let's just go back what I was talking about before. You've got a vehicle, it's a reasonably modern vehicle, and it's got, you know, these brand new tyres on it, and it's predominantly designed for highway, road use, residential. On a good, hard, black surface, asphalt surface, the contact patch that the tyre has on the road is pretty good, right? So it's got grooves in it, and the grooves are in it to disperse and allow the water to be pumped out from within the contact patch, right? So that you've got rubber touching the road. That's why the grooves are there. If we never had rain and you were going to drive on perfect hard surfaces all the time, well, then you'd probably have something that was more like a slick tyre that we use for racing cars, right? So you've got 100% contact patch. So we've got this contact patch. It's there for those, as I say, predominantly hard surface. And when it rains, the grooves in them are designed to pump the water out. So that's the predominant use of it. So rubber is obviously a product that has got grip. You rub it along on a hard surface, it creates a grip. That's all good. That's a solid surface. It doesn't move, right? Then you go and you put that same car on a loose surface, on a gravel road, dirt road or whatever. All of a sudden, that surface underneath that tire is not stable. It's not stable. It's moving. There's things on it that shift. So the tire is sitting on top of the surface. And then when you put load through it, if you turn the car or you're accelerating or trying to stop, that surface is moving because the tire forces the surface to move. So that creates an instability with your contact patch on that surface. And so straight away, there's not the grip. You take a tie and you rub it sideways on an asphalt surface, you'll feel the friction. You rub that tire sideways on a loose surface, there is no friction. It moves. Mm. And so that's what you feel when you drive on a loose surface, is the tire doesn't actually have a connection with the road. And so you're driving along, you turn the wheel, and the tire slips across the surface, or the surface goes with it. And that's what you're feeling. Straight away, when you're driving on a loose surface, you've got to take a lot more time to slow the car down. You've got to be much more gentle on your steering, much more gentle on the throttle, and more so on the brakes as well. So a corner in the dry that you could take easily at 100 kilometers an hour, on a loose surface, it might be 40 kilometers an hour, might be 50 kilometers an hour, depending on what it is, because of that situation. So all that stuff, not taught, how are you supposed to know?
Luke's passenger in the prior comment was talking about the car spinning out of control, yelling about not braking. Let's find out where the story picks up from here.
Despite the fact that my passenger beside me was yelling out, don't brake, don't brake, it seemed to me like the only logical thing that I could actually do to avoid us actually hitting this tree that was coming up. When I did that, the car flipped completely and we ended up rolling a couple of times. My driver's side door was against the dirt. Oh, there was just dirt all through the car that had come in through the window. My passenger was stuck in her seatbelt, dangling on top of my neck. She couldn't move. She couldn't pull herself up. She was crying, trying to get herself out of the car. I was pretty limited in terms of what I could do. I remember just being in there and I was stuck and I could smell petrol. I learned later there was a fire that had started as well, a small fire that had started underneath the dashboard. Everything had just been flung from the back of the car into the front of the car, and we had someone else who was travelling with us, but they were quite a way back, was my understanding. We had gone ahead of them. The whole time I'm just thinking, I was like, I don't know what's going to happen. Like, my passenger can't get out. I didn't know how hurt she was, and I can't get out because she's above me. I'm trapped here at the bottom of the car. I was just really lucky that we missed the tree. Everything kind of, I don't know, it sounds really cliche, but everything sort of slowed down when it all happened. I remember thinking to myself, I was really focused and I was like, this is how I'm going to fix this, when we started to skid out. Thinking to myself, I was like, you've just got to hold on. I just tried to stay as rigid as possible because I was like, I've got to stay in control of this car. And so we were really lucky that we had somebody else with us because, you know, in a lot of cases, when you're in the middle of nowhere, no one's coming along. No one's finding you if you've had an accident. The person who was behind us jumped up onto the top of the car, which is now, if you can imagine, is now the passenger side door. And they tried to lift my passenger out through the window. They couldn't get the door open. The door was jammed. The car had been buckled a bit. She was hurt. She had hurt her neck. And she was also hanging above me. And to the point that when they started to take her seatbelt off, she started to drop even further onto me, and they weren't able to lift her to get her out of the car. Once she was out of the car, it was a lot easier for me to get out through the passenger side window. I was really lucky that I wasn't actually hurt at all. The car itself was not in a good state, and I know it seems like it's not even the first thing you think about, but I felt really terrible about that because, like I said, it wasn't even my car, and I was going too fast. I was not familiar with the road conditions, and assuming that it would be exactly the same as driving on, you know, a normal road in the city. We were just really lucky that we didn't roll into the tree because we were not far away from it. When I got out of the car and looked at where we had actually stopped, we were very much in a whole lot of smaller trees, but that big tree that I'd tried to avoid was not too far away from the car. And we were going fast enough that that would have been a major problem.
That second last line is actually one of the big takeaways here, isn't it? I mean, the fact that it was an unfamiliar piece of road, speed wasn't appropriate for it, given the lack of experience and so on. That is one of the big takeaways here, isn't it?
Yeah, I think another big takeaway is, who would want to be in that situation? Hmm. Wouldn't you want to do whatever you can at any stage, if you've listened to that, to avoid ever being in that situation? And I know how terrified he was. I recall it myself. And when it happened, when I put myself in that situation to cause a crash. Mm. It's nothing you want to ever experience at all. Both he and his passenger were okay, and that's because they didn't come to a sudden stop. They didn't hit that big tree. All the energy was basically released through the car rolling, but it never came to a complete stop. If it had come to a stop while traveling at speed against that tree, the outcome would have been very, very different. And that's why, you know, people end up being seriously injured or killed, is because they have a crash, but it's not the crash or the accident that starts to happen. It's what happens when the car or the vehicle, how it comes to a stop. And head-on crashes, you know, we have them all over the place. We had one here in New Zealand just the other day, 5 people killed, 2 cars head-on. Oh. The outcome of a head-on crash in an open road, it's never going to be good. So, you know, fate is a big part of it. And I just implore people listening that this is why you need to pay attention. This is why you need to understand the dynamics of a car. This is why you need to know what ABS is, why tires are tires, why you've got to understand different conditions, and why you should always be paying attention only on your driving when you're driving, so you don't have to experience that. And for anyone that thinks it'll never happen to me, you're in la-la land, absolute dead set la-la land.
I was always taught 3 things not to hit: big trees, telegraph poles, or oncoming traffic, because they're the things that will really, really hurt. There's nearly always a choice. Find something else. If you're going to hit something, find something else, not one of those 3 things.
Well, you focus in, don't you, on the thing. Focus, you look at it, and that's where you
end up going. What you look at, that's what you hit.
Murph, it's probably situational. Was braking the right thing or the wrong thing to do? And the passenger saying, don't brake. You know, obviously every scenario is different, but you often hear people referring to the fact that one of the things you need to do is stop or slow the car.
So obviously, if you hit something at 100 k's, it's going to hurt you more than if you hit it at 20 k's an hour. But firstly, we should be teaching people not to hit anything.
Or to get into that scenario.
Yeah. That's our first thing.
That's right.
And it's not shouldn't be about the speed, but, you know, yeah, you shouldn't be hitting anything at that sort of speed.
But you shouldn't be hitting anything at all. Accidents do happen. People make mistakes. That's a given. I think there's a bit of a belief out there that people that are crashing and doing things, they're doing something wrong at the time, right? It's premeditated. Something's happening. Well, that's not the case. The majority of people that are having crashes and they're being injured and killed is because they make genuine mistakes because, again, it's what they don't know. So they find themselves in situations like Luke. He didn't know. So he had a crash. They don't go out there to be a dickhead, be a hoon, you know, to drive too fast. They just don't have the ability because of a lack of skill and understanding and awareness and all those things. And those pieces of the puzzle all come together. And often people get away with stuff because one piece of the puzzle didn't present itself, right? Mm. And they carry on not even knowing that they were that close to being a casualty.
Can we just underscore, Murph, for youngsters who may not have seen it happen before, can a car roll over much easier than they realise? You know, they only ever see them on their wheels, really. They probably don't realise that it can happen.
Cars need something to activate a roll. They've got to be tripped up. They've got to slide off the side of the road, and the wheel and the tyres got to fall into something or grab on something and trip it up, right? And that's the laws of physics. You know, you've obviously got to have a certain speed. However the car is turning, you've got to have some kind of friction generated somehow on some part of it. The road surface has got to change. You've got to go into a ditch. There's all sorts of factors, and there's plenty of factors that can cause it. But they won't just roll for no reason.
Let's circle back to Luke now, and I dare say he's learned a thing or two from this incident.
I think it's made me act differently in terms of my level of confidence with driving on roads that you're not familiar with, which isn't a bad thing. I think if you are driving on a road that's not a sealed road, and even a sealed road, like if you don't know what's around the corner, it makes sense to take that cautiously. And I didn't. When I was driving out on this dirt road, I now take corners a lot more slow. And that's any corner now. It's not necessarily just a corner that's, you know, in the outback or anything like that. I drive more cautiously and I'm more aware of what could go wrong. I haven't had an accident since then. It was a decent accident to chalk up as the first one that I've ever had. But I do think that for me, the learning from that has been that things can happen very quickly. We were driving normally. My confidence was all there. I was feeling pretty good about the drive. And then within a second, everything changed. And it can happen that quickly. We were really lucky that day. I sometimes think about how that could have gone worse. And I think that anybody who is driving on any road condition, but in particular loose road like dirt or gravel, you need to be really mindful about what that means for the car and how the car is going to handle. And I was not really prepared for that. Think about what it is that your car is on. Think about what you're driving on and think about how that's going to impact your car's ability to react to what you want the car to do. Just because you want to stop quickly, if you're on a road that doesn't allow that to happen, then you need to take that into account.
Some really good final thoughts there from Luke. Can I bring the both of you in from the driver training perspective? What are the key messages we should leave the audience with today?
It's great to hear that he has learnt. I mean, all the driver training stuff we've ever done, I mean, when it comes down to it, nearly all drivers think they're great drivers and very few are without being rude. We all need to get a lot better training. All drivers, I think, should be doing regular, you know, driver training or whatever. It's a skill set. It's a cognitive skill that needs constantly honing in and training for. I mean, all race drivers use iRacing, Assetto Corsa, you know, whatever, Gran Turismo, to actually learn tracks and learn racecraft and what have you, and to keep their eye in and keep at that high level of skill. Mm. We don't do any of that for road drivers. And that's where I think, you know, one, we don't teach them properly in the first place. They're not educated well enough. They're not given a broad experience. And then we just let them out there and most of them think they're great when sadly they're not.
Yep, that is right. We've got this stigma around motorsport and that it's so dangerous. The most dangerous place you can drive a car is on our roads by far, by thousands of percent more. Because we're all prepared. We, you know, as you just said, Lise, you know, the preparation that goes into our driving, we go practicing, we test, we're on simulators, we think about driving constantly. When we're driving in a race car, we're not texting, you know, we haven't got kids screaming in the back, we don't have
you're
a whole
driving
list
the same
of jobs
direction.
To do. We're all driving in the same direction.
You've got, you know, tyre walls all over the shop, you've got an ambulance
safety.
Right there.
Yeah, lots
so
of safety.
That's why race drivers can speed. You know, you've got roll bars, you've got helmets, all that stuff. You can't go and do that on road. Mm. Anybody who thinks that that's cool to do that on road is just a lunatic. It's so much more dangerous.
I would not want to have, I mean, and I've had a car crash. I would rather have a crash in a racing car at 200 kilometres an hour and be completely out of control and have fate decide the outcome than have a crash in any road car at 50 kilometres an hour. It is just a hideous experience. And it comes down to, if you don't have the training and you haven't had the training, pay attention. Do not be distracted. Know where you're going, look where you're going, have great peripheral awareness of what's going on around you. Be prepared for anything. Don't expect other people to do the things you are expecting them to do, because people don't. People make mistakes. So if you're driving along thinking that everybody else on the road, you're doing everything right, and you think everyone else is going to do everything right, again, you're an idiot, because that's just not the case.
In the first 3 years of driving, over 90% of fatalities are caused by driver error. And that's, as you said, Murph, it's not necessarily about them being a hoon and, you know, being irresponsible. Literally, they'll make a mistake that they might not have even understood that it was a mistake.
Just like Luke.
Yeah.
Can we finish? You've made, on the other side of the ditch there, a great announcement very recently around the Street Smart program. There is a commitment of 3 years of support for it from Tony Quinn. There is a real push from you guys to try and get government to notice the benefits of this. It's incredibly affordable to do this. There is no excuse, really, for parents listening not to put their kids through a proper driver training program of this kind. And why are governments not listening? Please, why?
I don't know whether I can't answer that last part, Rusty. I really can't. I mean, I bang my head against a wall, as Lisa does, on trying to get the bureaucrats, who aren't experts, and they've proven that year after year with just wasteful spending. But yeah, we need to make it affordable, because otherwise people aren't going to do it. So it's $149 to come and do a Street Smart Day, which puts you through a whole series of exercises all designed around awareness and creating awareness around what is safe by using some of the tools like ABS and the likes, and cognitively feeling what happens in an emergency situation and the like. So bring a parent along, so we get a double up on the information going to not just the young driver, but also the parent or caregiver as well. And we know it works because we've had the feedback from those that have come to the course. We know that it makes a difference. We know it saves lives.
For $149, that is amazing value. We used to do a lot of driver training stuff, and you know it's hard to do it for anything under $500. Mm. So you've obviously, yeah. you know, you've put a lot of effort into this to make it so affordable. Yeah.
And that's what the money that Tony Quinn's put in is doing to allow us to make it $149.
It's streetsmart.nz for those listening on the other side of the ditch. Yep. That's how they find out more about it. And we thank you for your insights in this edition of the podcast, Murph.
My pleasure. The more of this, the better. Let's keep spreading the word, Lise.
On the next episode of Keep Your Wheels On.
Insurance might not seem like the most exciting topic, but we have a story for you that will prove why it's incredibly important.
First of all, I didn't really have the money for the $30,000 loan, but I also didn't have the money for another $10,000 loan to get another car. So it really started to sink in what a stupid mistake that was.
We will chat with an insurance expert. It might seem expensive, but you'll get a greater understanding of the importance of being covered and what can happen if you aren't.
Third party does not cover your car, so that can get you into a bit of trouble if you're financed.
I'm Rusty.
And I'm Lisa.
And this is Keep Your Wheels On. Keep Your Wheels On is a listener production brought to you in partnership with My Drive School. Hosted by me, Greg Rust, and Lisa Scaife. Audio production by Kelly Fulston. And executive producer is Todd Stevens.
The Keep Your Wheels On podcast was funded by the Australian Government.
Listener.